Listener supported. WNYC Studios.
Hi, Brian Lehrer here. Up next, Brian Lehrer Weekend. Three of our favorite segments from the week packaged together for you to listen to on the weekend. So enjoy, and I'll see you back on the radio Monday at 10 a.m. on WNYC and WNYC.org. Brian Lehrer Show on WNYC. Good morning again, everyone. Now running for president, my next guest, the Rhodes Scholar, Afghanistan War veteran, gay 37-year-old mayor of South Bend, Indiana, Pete Buttigieg. Ready or not to be the nominee, he is definitely a rising star in the National Democratic Party, and he has written a book. I think it's required that you write a book under these circumstances. I see Kamala Harris, Elizabeth Warren, and Joe Biden also have books now. The one from Mayor Buttigieg is called Shortest Way Home, One Mayor's Challenge and a Model for America's Future. Mayor Buttigieg, it's an honor. Thank you for coming to New York. Welcome to our studio.
Thanks for having me. Good to be with you.
And we'll cycle back and get into your book and your bio, but I'm sure our listeners want to know first, why do you want to be president?
Well, I think that this is a moment that is calling for something entirely new. And I feel that especially as somebody from a younger generation. You know, I think coming from a generation where, you know, today's the one-year anniversary of the Parkland shooting. I was in high school when Columbine happened. I feel like we become the school shooting generation. We're also the generation that provided most of the troops after 9/11, the generation that is going to be dealing with climate change for the rest of our lives, not in theory, but in practice. And if nothing changes economically, the first generation perhaps to make less than our parents. So I think there's a direct personal urgent stake that my generation has in political leadership and political choices. And I think that means we need to put forward candidates at the highest level too.
You told CNBC, at no other moment in the last 100 years would somebody like me be taken seriously in this conversation. Is that about more than what you just said about your generation?
Yeah, not just my youth, but also being a mayor from a smaller city. I'm not sure that would have rated you a place on a presidential debate stage in the past. At the same time, I think we live at a moment when people are hoping that Washington will look a little more like our best-run cities and towns, not the other way around. And so we spent a lot of time describing how the relevant experience of executive leadership in helping to transform a city, especially in the industrial Midwest, a region that has largely been overlooked, especially by my party, could be the exact right kind of experience to take our conversation about the presidency to a better place.
So if you said at no other moment in the last 100 years would somebody like you be taken seriously, do you think you're being taken seriously?
Well, so far so good. I mean, you know, we've been in Iowa, we've been in national media, and I think the conversation has been a very serious one. Look, I get that there's an obligation for me to demonstrate what we are doing in this conversation and to demonstrate viability over time, but I can tell that we've hit a nerve not only with the generational message, but the substance of what I'm trying to communicate, and we're getting supporters from every state in the union.
And listeners, your opportunity to ask a question of one of the declared presidential hopefuls, South Bend, Indiana Mayor Pete Buttigieg, 212-433-WNYC, 212-433-9692. Do you want to just maybe like spell your name, because that's the first question that people, what is he saying, Pete? What?
Yeah, I mean, around South Bend, they mostly just call me Mayor Pete. Buttigieg is actually a very common name in Malta, which is where my father immigrated from. He came to the U.S. for educational opportunities, then became a U.S. citizen in the 70s. Now, where I come from, an unpronounceable name is not always a bad thing. On the West Side, a lot of people assume you're Polish or Hungarian, and that can even get you a couple votes. But the good thing I have going for me is that elections typically are multiple choice. You don't have to spell it. You just have to pick me out of a lineup.
Buttigieg.
You got it. That's exactly right.
And why do you think you'd make the best president, better than Senator Harris or Senator Warren or Senator Klobuchar, to take three leading contenders?
Well, I'm not really focused on any of the others. There are many people in this conversation that I admire, and with what might be something like 20 people looking at it, I'm not sure it's a good use of energy. What I will say is that I'm not like the others. I have a different personal experience, a different regional background, a different generational orientation. And, you know, I have a lot of respect for the work that's done in Washington, but I actually think it might be a virtue that I am not somebody who gets up in the morning and goes to work in Washington.
How much is your argument that you would be the most likely to defeat Donald Trump, assuming you're both the nominees?
Well, people tend to look for something very different than what they've got. And if nothing else, I'm more or less the exact opposite of this president. I think I have a different style. I actually come from middle America. I have the orientation of somebody who's actually done the work on the ground. It might sound cheeky to say as the youngest guy in the conversation, but I'm also talking about experience a lot. I have more experience in government than the president, and for that matter, more executive experience than the vice president. I have more military experience than anyone who's walked into that office since George H.W. Bush. And I think that might be a good contrast for people who are just exhausted by what we see right now in the White House.
There are other people in the race, like the ones I mentioned before, who might also be able to say they're really the opposite of Donald Trump, just on different factors.
And that's fine. You can be the opposite of him in a lot of different ways. You could be a woman of color, and that's obviously a big contrast. I also think following up the oldest president in American history with the youngest might be a good move for this country.
If you consider yourself the most electable, does that assume that there would be less bias in the swing vote electorate against a gay man than against a straight woman?
Well, here's what I learned in Indiana. You know, when I decided to come out, it was the right time in my personal life. It was not necessarily the obvious time in my political career. We were in the middle of a re-election campaign, but it was just time. When I did it, we didn't know what the political implications would be. But in the end, I got re-elected with 80% of the vote. And that was in a socially conservative blue-collar community. To me, that says that more people than not are prepared to evaluate you just based on who you are, what you have to offer, what your ideas are, and how good of a messenger you are in putting forward those ideas.
My guest is Democratic presidential hopeful Pete Buttigieg. He is the mayor of South Bend, Indiana, and the author of a new book called Shortest Way Home, One Mayor's Challenge and a Model for America's Future. Some phone calls are starting to come in. We'll take some in a couple of minutes. Listeners, 212-433-WNYC. We have a couple of open lines still, 212-433-9692. If you have a question for this presidential hopeful, why'd you join the military?
Well, there had been a tradition of military service in my family, but for a long time, I always had an excuse not to get around to it. I was studying, I was overseas, I had a busy job.
You were a Rhodes Scholar.
Yeah. But one thing that happened while I was a Rhodes Scholar was that there were graduates of the Naval Academy in my class, and I just admired those guys so much and learned a lot from them. The thing that really put me over the edge, actually, was when I was volunteering for Barack Obama. I took some time off work, got some friends, we got in a car, we went to Iowa, we knocked on doors, and I was in a lot of rural communities. Low-income communities that seemed to just be emptying out their youth into the military. Every time I knocked on a door and I met a young person, it seemed like he was on his way to basic training or getting ready to go into the Guard. And it set me into reflecting how many of my Harvard classmates had gone on to serve, and I could count the ones I could think of on one hand. Which is funny because for other generations, it was actually in the military that different backgrounds and different classes came to mix with each other. It's where young John F. Kennedy or George H.W. Bush wound up on more or less equal terms with somebody who had a background from a Midwestern farm family. The more I thought about it, the less I had an excuse. The less it made any sense that I hadn't, at least in the reserve, been vulnerable to being called up like the others. And I also thought, with a background in Arabic, I thought I might have something to offer. Now, the recruiter, I later learned, wrote down that my minor at Harvard had been in aerobics. But eventually we got that sorted out. I became an intelligence officer, and serving is one of the most educational and important things that I've done in my life.
You're kind of saying, in a way, that you decided to enlist so that some other working class guy wouldn't have to.
That's one way of looking at it. Another way of looking at it is participating in an American project with people so different from me that the only thing we might have had in common at all was the fact that we were American. And that's how it felt when I was deployed, you know, on the ground in Afghanistan, getting into a vehicle for a convoy movement. You're learning to trust people with your life that may have very different background, age, gender, region, politics, very different politics. Some people that I learned to trust with my life, and we need more of that. But it shouldn't take going to war to get that, which is one of the reasons I think national service deserves more attention in U.S. Policy space.
And so does your experience there inform a position that you might have on President Trump's interest in greatly reducing the number of American troops still in Afghanistan? He's got that position from his perspective. A lot of people on the left also say, you know, we're fighting an endless war that really has no upside for the United States anymore.
Well, on one hand, having served in that war makes me very attuned to the fact that we can't continue with endless war. There are people who are old enough to get deployed now who weren't even alive when 9/11 took place, and far from having a memory of the authorization in Congress that made that possible. The other side of the coin is it also makes me very attuned to the dangers of doing it the way this president does. You know, when you're serving in the military, you have a certain level of trust, and you have to have a certain level of faith that as you go up your chain of command, the people who hold your life in their hands report to policymakers who in turn take their duties seriously. And so when you hear about a president surprising the Pentagon on issues of war and peace by tweet, this is an unbelievably dangerous way to be making policy. So yes, of course we need to end endless war, but that's not the way to do it.
And what about the policy itself? Get out of Afghanistan, get out of Syria?
Yeah, we definitely need to bring our presence there to an end. That's one of the reasons why it's encouraging, if the Taliban are really ready to lay down their weapons and come to peace talks, that we have to engage that. What I'm more concerned about, though, is the fact that the Afghan government, you know, the one that was actually democratically elected by the Afghan people, and that a lot of Afghan lives and American lives have gone into making possible, seems to be left on the sidelines. They need to be a party to these talks, too, or whatever peace we come up with won't last. And the last thing we want to see is another attack generated from Afghanistan that leads to yet another war that could have been avoided.
My guest is Democratic presidential hopeful Pete Buttigieg, the mayor of South Bend, Indiana, and the author now of Short Way Home, One Mayor's Challenge and a Model for America's Future. Our lines are just chock full of people wanting to ask you questions. And when we come back from a break, we'll start taking some of those questions. Beginning with, I will reveal Miles on line 8, who wants to know where you stand on the Green New Deal. Stay with us. Brian Lehrer on WNYC with Democratic presidential hopeful Pete Buttigieg, also author of the new book, Shortest Way Home, One Mayor's Challenge and a Model for America's Future. He's the mayor of South Bend, Indiana. He would certainly be the youngest president ever elected at age 34. He would be our first.
39. Well, now. I would be in.
Oh, I said, I'm sorry.
I'm 37.
And I said 30.
Yeah, 34. I said
34.
Quite make the constitutional test.
That's right, because you have to be 35
right.
And you're 37. He would be our first openly gay mayor, president. Wouldn't be the first Rhodes Scholar.
No, that's true.
Bill Clinton was a Rhodes Scholar. I don't know if any other. And we're going to go to the call. So you're in New York with the book. Obviously, I saw you were doing other media here in New York this morning, CNN, MSNBC. Are you also doing fundraising, since a lot of people who run for national office use New York that way? Is somebody squiring you around the salons of wealthy New York?
So our focus has mostly been on the media today, but yeah, absolutely. New York is also a place where I can find supporters, people who are willing to contribute to our campaign. A lot of that's happening online at the grassroots level. We also want to come to any city where I find myself, come to people who really care about progressive causes and Democratic Party's future, and ask them for help.
Are there people or organizations you won't take money from? Elizabeth Warren is making a very big show of not accepting corporate PACs and certain other categories of money?
Yeah, I don't know that I've made a show of it, but I've made a decision not to take corporate PAC money. I'm trying to keep it pretty simple. I think a lot of money from more objectionable sources is very unlikely to find its way to supporting a candidacy like mine anyway. But I don't think it's going to serve us well to take corporate PAC money.
Miles and Elizabeth, as promised, you're on WNYC with Mayor Buttigieg. Hi, Miles.
Hi, thank you so much for taking my call. I'd like to ask Mayor Pete about how he thinks the Green New Deal could be practically implemented and what that might mean.
Great question. So first of all, what I love about the Green New Deal is that it treats climate like the emergency that it is. And that's something that generationally, also regionally and mayorally, I feel very strongly. I found myself activating the Emergency Operations Center in our community twice in a space of 18 months, both for floods that should have been once in a lifetime or rarer. That means that things are changing around us, and this is no longer a theoretical issue. It is a practical one. The insight of the Green New Deal is it recognizes that this can also be a matter of job creation. Now, let's be honest. The Green New Deal, as currently formulated, is more a set of goals than it is a fully articulated roadmap on how to get there. And I think everybody in the policy space is thinking about different things we can put forward that would help make those goals actually come true. One thing I'm perhaps a little more attuned to as a mayor is thinking about the patterns of how our cities are developed and how federal funding could make those more sustainable. I think massive research and development is needed at a scale that we really haven't attempted outside the military space to bend further bend the cost curve on things like solar, especially at a time when solar PV technology has the potential not only to help boost our sustainability and reduce our carbon footprint, but make individual houses energy independent or close to it. Right now in South Bend, we are partnering with Habitat for Humanity to build net zero energy homes. And what that means, not just environmentally, but economically, for families that can have one less thing to worry about in terms of paying a power bill because the home itself can generate its own energy. That is the direction we need to move in. And it won't happen without a major level of investment in research.
So are you saying you embrace the premise of the Green New Deal, or don't you like to use that term, which is, of course, being discussed a lot now within the party and across party lines?
Yeah, no, I do embrace the premise because the Green New Deal is correct both in identifying the level of emergency we have. I mean, look, the destructive power of climate change is on par with that of a Great Depression or a World War. So why wouldn't we mount the same level of national effort with the same level of national urgency that we did for something like the space race or the Marshall Plan? I think it calls for that level of investment. Yes, there is some major technical challenges to getting there, but since when is America afraid of major technical challenges?
That's the green part. What about the New Deal part, like a guaranteed job for people who need it or any of the other sort of New Deal provisions?
Well, I live in a place, let me give you an example from our county. One of the biggest announcements of union auto jobs being expanded in our community is at a company called SF Motors that is based in Silicon Valley that makes electric vehicles. And they're hoping to have those out on the market soon. So you got union auto workers, blue-collar people in the industrial Midwest with new opportunity thanks to the green economy. I believe the potential for more jobs and a more just economy is absolutely there. If I were thinking about something that's being talked about, like a jobs guarantee, I would link it to national service opportunities. And over time, we'll have plenty of time to develop fully articulated policy proposals. But I want to start with the values and the mission. And I think the values and the mission behind the concept of the Green New Deal deserve to be taken seriously and deserve our support.
Let me play a clip of another Democrat from the Midwest. This may or may not surprise you, but this is former U.S. Senator from Missouri, Claire McCaskill, who was just defeated, as you know, by a Republican in November in that pro-Trump state. She was on MSNBC's Morning Joe just a few hours ago, and she said this about presidential candidates being lemmings, her word, when it comes to the Green New Deal.
Candidly, I keep asking people, give me the chapter and verse, literally, of the statutory language that the new Green Deal embraces. And as far as I can tell, there's no there at this point. So maybe that's why they're doing it. I do think that they're going to have to figure out a way to distinguish themselves from the rest of the people running. You want to know how Donald Trump got elected president? All the Republicans fell in behind him once he was nominated. He got elected president because he was the Republican nominee. And that we're going to see some of that on the Democratic side. So how he distinguished himself in that crowd, he was definitely different. My opinion, the worst candidate, but he was different. So who's going to distinguish themselves by not being lemming-like? And saying, yeah, me too, yeah, me too, yeah, me too, New Green Deal, Medicare for all. Who is going to seem more thoughtful and step back from the group and try to carve a different path?
Claire McCaskill on Morning Joe. What do you think about that whole skeptical framing and calling people lemmings?
Well, you know, I was on Morning Joe with her. We had a good exchange, and I really admire Senator McCaskill in many ways.
You were on with her?
Yeah. Where I maybe come at it a little differently, as somebody who also is a Democrat in a red state who has many times relied on Republican and independent support, is for me, getting Republican independent support is not always about pretending to be more conservative than I am or trying to find an ideological middle. Sometimes it's just about making sure you command respect based on the extent to which you are seen to hold true to your own values, even by people whose values are somewhat different. The other thing I would add is that I'm concerned about the Democratic impulse to pounce on the chapter and verse, as she said, of the statutory details. That's what we did in 2016. And a lot of other times we go right to the PowerPoint, right to the binder, right to the 14-point plan. And one of the reasons we have been politically outmaneuvered by the right for, I would argue, the last 30 or 40 years is that they have been arguing in terms of values. And we have been arguing in terms of policies. Policy matters. I'm a policy guy. But if we're ignoring the policy debate, if we're ignoring the values debate, you know, they have basically owned, for example, the idea of freedom in the political space, where to me, as a progressive, freedom means being able to start a new business because you don't have to worry that leaving your job means losing your health care. Freedom means that if your credit card company rips you off, you're free to sue them. Freedom in my personal life has meant the freedom to marry the person you love. I think freedom, rightly understood, very often points you in a progressive direction. But we, for a whole generation, lost the argument about freedom because we were busy talking about the intricate workings of our policy prescriptions and ignoring the deeper dialogue that was passing us by in the American political space.
Pete in Sussex, you're on WNYC with Pete Buttigieg. Hi, Pete.
Hi, yeah. I'm just wanted to ask the mayor how what his – I think I got the answer in the last question he just answered, but what he feels on Medicare for All and if he supports it or not.
Yeah, so I'm supportive of Medicare for All for the simple reason that I don't think it makes any sense for pretty much everybody living in a developed country except us to enjoy some kind of universal health care. I also think it's a great example of how the debate got away from us because, you know, if you think about the right-wing position on healthcare, like a pure right-wing position, it's basically all corporate, free for all, no regulation. If you think about the left-wing position, again, a pure left-wing position, that would be nationalized healthcare, socialized medicine, if you will, something like what they have in the UK, where you have publicly owned hospitals and medical practices. The compromise, the middle ground, is a single-payer system, where you have private doctors and hospitals, but a public insurance plan. And somehow this middle ground has been portrayed in the American debate as if it were something from the furthest fringes of the left wing. Now, I do think that we need to be realistic about how you get there. You can't flip a switch overnight. My take is that you implement something that I would call Medicare for all who want it. In other words, make something resembling Medicare available on the exchanges as a public option. And then if people like me are right, that it's the better way to go, organically, that will move you pretty quickly just through the competitive process toward a single payer system.
But if all you're doing is putting a public option on the exchanges, then people would have to buy that policy just like they'd be buying a private insurance company's policy. I don't know how competitively different. You already have an idea that it would be priced, but it's not Medicare for All.
Well, I think it ends with Medicare. It's the roadmap to Medicare for All, but I think that's where it takes you. Now, even when we get Medicare for All, we still have some issues around costs in the American healthcare system. Some of them are a result of the patchwork we have now, but some of them are problems internal to Medicare and the way CMS works. Look, we can quibble over the policy mechanisms on how to do it. For example, do you just ask people to buy in, or do you continue on the path we have of subsidies? Do you raise this money in taxes and pay it back to people in the form of healthcare? Those are questions of policy design. The question of principle is that every American ought to get universal health care coverage, and you shouldn't be on your own wandering the corporate markets in order to get it.
Wade in Queens, you're on WNYC with presidential hopeful Pete Buttigieg, mayor of South Bend, Indiana. Hi, Wade.
Hi. Mayor, I just called to tell you that I'm from South Bend, Indiana, born and raised there.
Oh, that's great.
Been here for many, many years. You're the best sounding thing I've heard in this out of the Democratic candidates. And I will gladly work for you. My sister worked for you when you were running for Secretary of State.
Oh, wow.
She's up in Gary. So you have a backer here. I'll help you out. Vote for you and so forth.
Well,
so,
thank you. Us South Bend types got to stick together. So I appreciate the support.
Wait, I'm going to assume that you're not actually on his staff and calling as a plant.
I am not on his staff, that's for sure.
You don't sound like a plant. So what's the best thing he's done for South Bend as far as you know?
Well, I, to be honest with you, I don't know a lot about – well, the best thing I've heard is that he – for me personally, I think he was mayor when they planted a marker in my neighborhood, which is one of the first neighborhoods to desegregate.
Oh, yeah, Better Homes. Yeah, that's close to where I grew up, too.
My mother was vice president of that organization.
Oh, good, good.
Long past. So that was a great thing for me personally.
And such an important story.
Nothing but good things from everybody back there. I don't get back there too much, but
well, thank you. Come back and you can see the plaque there. Yeah, it's a really important story about how racial integration came to a part of our city that hadn't seen it in housing. So thanks for that.
Wade, thank you very much. And chapter one of your book is called The South Bend I Grew Up In. I assume it's a little different from, say, the South Bronx, where Ocasio-Cortez's father ran a small business. Tell us about it.
Yeah, so I loved growing up in South Bend. I didn't realize until I left that it was not normal to have crumbling factory buildings or vacant abandoned houses around you. They were kind of part of the furniture. And what I did, pay attention to were the kinds of things that kids care about, you know, the parks and my friends and having things to do. What I realized, though, is as I grew up and certainly when I left, was just how hard things had been for our city. And I suppose I knew that even growing up because by the time I was 18, I too had bought into that idea that success had to mean getting out, that success meant leaving South Bend. And that's exactly what I did. I was on the East Coast for college. I went overseas for graduate study.
And South Bend was a company manufacturing town with a Studebaker auto plant.
Yeah, I mean, you got to understand, in its day, Studebaker was as big as any of the big three automakers. It was a huge part of the economy, locally and even nationally. We were like a company town that lost its company. They shut down in 1963. And I spent my boyhood just surrounded by these hulking masses of old factories. There's one right now that still stands. It's 800,000 square feet. But we figured out a way to save it, and we're actually transitioning it into a tech center, taking advantage of the fact that those same railway lines that were so useful in the industrial years are now also where a lot of the fiber optic cable conduit carrying the internet goes. And we got a nascent business in data centers right alongside our advanced manufacturing sector.
It's cities and towns like that. I think South Bend tends to be a Democratic place, but a lot of places like that voted for President Trump. People in a lot of places like that because they're so frustrated with their economic conditions and they didn't see Hillary Clinton being the kind of candidate who would change things enough. And now Trump says the manufacturing jobs are coming back under his policies. Here he is on that just last month.
I imagine you've all seen the incredible job growth, 312,000 jobs, which took everybody by surprise. Estimates range from 160 to 180,000, and this really took people by surprise. This is a great number. I think it has a lot to do with the factories and with the companies that are moving back into the United States who have left, and now they're coming back to us instead of being in other countries.
Are they coming back, and do his policies have anything to do with it?
I don't think the word back really has a lot of meaning anymore when we're talking about the economy. Yes, there is manufacturing job growth. It began under President Obama, where I think unemployment went from something like 12 to something like 5. And then under President Trump, it's gone from something like 5 to something like 4. So I guess he can take credit for having not yet killed the Obama recovery. That's not the same thing as being able to turn back the clock. An honest politics cannot revolve around the word again. Yes, we have manufacturing. We're proud of our manufacturing in South Bend. A lot of our most compelling employers are in advanced manufacturing. But the truth is, as technology continues to make machines and workers more productive, the manufacturing will not be as labor-intensive as it used to be. You know, for example, that car company I was talking about will produce tens of thousands of cars with fewer than 1,000 workers. It used to be a very different ratio when Studebaker was in its heyday in South Bend. So what does that mean? It means that we need to make sure that people have the right skill set to succeed in advanced manufacturing, which is very, very sophisticated. If you're on a shop floor or a machining plant, this is not a guy, you know, carving a piece of metal. This is a guy operating a computer terminal on a CNC machine that's doing
it. But it's also not the mass employer that the old manufacturers were.
Right. And in a way, that's better. Look, I would rather have 20,000 jobs spread across 200 employers, 100 at a time, than all in one factory that could go bust overnight. So
but only if the new jobs pay as well, right?
Yes. And we've got to recognize that as people are finding new forms of work, whether it's the continued manufacturing sector we have, or the data center industry that we're cultivating in South Bend that didn't even exist in the Studebaker days, or whether we're talking about the increasing role of the gig economy, the bottom line is people in my generation are going to change professions more often than our parents change jobs. And from a societal perspective, we can no longer just assume that most of us are going to have a lifelong relationship with a single employer. That's not just a challenge from an income perspective. That's a challenge from a social perspective, because a job isn't just a paycheck. It's how we explain how we fit in the world. And I think one reason why my part of the country did rebel, partly against Democrats. I mean, my county, which should be pretty Democratic, was basically 50-50 mm-hmm. in 2016. It's because we looked like we were the ones saying the system is perfectly fine. And that wasn't convincing, because it isn't true. The system has let a lot of people down. And a lot of people where I come from had no illusions about this candidate, now this president, being a good guy. They walked into the polling booth with their eyes wide open and voted to burn the house down to let America know how let down they are by the system. And that's one of the reasons why, while Democrats are right to build a message that says we can't go on like this and we need to change what's going on in the White House, we would be wrong to say, therefore, let's go back to some old normal that in truth can never be retrieved. We can only go forward.
Caitlin in Ridgewood, you're on WNYC with presidential hopeful Pete Buttigieg. Hey, Caitlin.
Hi, thanks for taking my call. So, you know, a lot of Democrats like to think that if we fix class and we can fix the racism and racial oppression that we have in this country. But I disagree. I think it's not the economy, stupid. It's racism from white people. And so when I hear you talk about your experience overseas and how you kind of found this common ground, it feels to me more like I don't see color. And that's, you know, that might not be the case, but I'm wondering, what are you doing and who are you listening to understand the experiences of Black people and other people of color in this country so that you can help with the racism that is flourishing through police departments and through our situation with public housing like NYCHA? Who are you listening to make sure you understand that? Because that's what our next president needs to be doing.
Well, I think you're pointing to something really important, which is that you got to ask yourself, how did we have a so-called economic anxiety election under conditions of full employment? A lot of it had to do with the ways that race was being used to divide the working class. I'm mayor of a diverse community. We're about 40 to 45% non-white. And so we have had to face these challenges head on. I absolutely see color, because that's such an important part of the lived experience of my constituents, and by the way, co-workers, in city administration and around the community. And we have faced some ferociously painful challenges, many of them, as you pointed to, around issues like policing and mistrust in communities of color between residents and officers whose job is to keep those residents safe. But we faced them head on, and there was a great deal of quantity time, not just quality time, listening, understanding. I mean, to understand the experience of people living different lives, when you're a mayor in a community like South Bend, you don't. It comes to you all the time. Sometimes I'll just set up a card table at a neighborhood center in the city and just take five-minute meetings back-to-back, sometimes for hours, with anybody who wants to talk. And a lot of what you hear about is the difference in the lived experience of racial minorities in our community. I would not have won even majority African-American districts in the city in my reelection if we hadn't found a way to build trust and address those issues. But that is not to negate those issues or to pretend they're not there, and most certainly not to pretend they're not going to matter in 2020 and beyond.
Pete Buttigieg is the mayor of South Bend, Indiana, and running for the Democratic nomination for president. And he's got a new book called Shortest Way Home, One Mayor's Challenge and a Model for America's Future. And Pete Buttigieg will be in conversation with New York Times columnist Frank Bruni at the Brooklyn Public Library at 7:30 p.m. next Monday, February 18th, auspiciously, that is President's Day. Thank you very much for joining us. I hope if you're still in, when the New York, New Jersey, and Connecticut primaries come close, you'll come back and campaign.
If you'll have me, I'd love to be here.
Thanks for joining us.
Thank you.
It's the Brian Lehrer Show on WNYC. Good morning again, everyone. And we continue now with our African American History Month series on Black migrations. That's the theme for this year, designated by the ASALH, the Association for the Study of African American Life and History, which founded Black History Month back in the 1970s. This week we'll talk about what's come to be called the Great Migration, the years from roughly 1916 to 1970. That's usually the time frame that's given when something like 6 million African Americans moved from the rural South to cities in the northern and western United States, very much including New York. We are joined once again by Gloria Brown Marshall, the civil rights attorney and professor of constitutional law at John Jay College of Criminal Justice, who is on the board of the ASALH. And we are also joined this week by Dominique Jean-Louis, a curatorial project historian at the New York Historical Society, where she worked on the Black Citizenship in the Age of Jim Crow exhibition. Dominique, welcome to WNYC.
Thanks so much. Pleased to be here.
And Professor Brown Marshall, welcome back.
Thank you.
I know you're on the phone with us from Havana, Cuba, so thanks for, you know, we saw Amy Klobuchar yesterday brave the snow to do her presidential campaign announcement. Thank you for braving the tropics to continue the series with us.
Anytime.
So, Dominique, let me start with you.
Sure.
As a curatorial historian, why is the Great Migration pegged roughly to 1916 as the start date?
Well, there are a number of reasons why 1916 becomes a useful way of thinking about it. On the one hand, you have the Pennsylvania Railroad Company actually recruiting about 12,000 black workers to come assist in railroad construction in the West, many of them from Florida, Georgia, around there. And their experiences of coming from the South and coming to cities up north and coming to construct the railroads, their experiences start to trickle down to the South and get more people interested in coming up. 1916 is also around the start of World War One, and the decrease in availability of jobs or the availability of immigrants from Europe create a kind of vacuum that black workers are then able to fill in. And so definitely there's migration from the South to the North and the West before 1916, but that's definitely when we start to see some of those big numbers that suggest that a larger phenomenon is at work.
And Professor Brown Marshall, the persistence of the Klan and lynchings and the low-wage sharecropper system on the farms must have also been push factors, as well as the pull factors from the North of the shortage of white labor, yes?
Yes, but the other part we have to look at is the oppression. Not only were there lynchings and murders, oppression of all kinds taking place, the reduced wages for farmers for their work, but they did not want those farmers to leave. So many of these people who migrated up north had to do it sneaking out. They had to leave by night, and some of these farmers actually, if they were caught, they were sent back to the farm. It was seen as an act of rebellion, like escaping from enslavement, when these farmers left the South in these horrible conditions to go up north, because the whites down there wanted them to maintain as a labor class making very little money. They did not want them to go to the North.
And some of the numbers that I saw on history.com are staggering. In 1900, 9 out of 10 African Americans lived in the South. By 1970, less than half did. Dominique, is that history as you understand it?
Absolutely. And it kind of comes in waves. There's certainly a slowdown around the time of the Great Depression, but it's a pretty constant motion northward, and the changes are changed the country forever, including today.
And between 1910 and 1920 alone, the black population of New York City grew by 2/3, Chicago by 1.5 times, or 150%, in Philadelphia by 500%, and Detroit by 600%. Professor Brown Marshall, that's just so staggering in terms of, you know, the movement of people over a short period of time.
But these were triggers as well. In 1919, the Red Summer, where you had, for example, in Elaine, Arkansas, and across the South, as well as in the North, these horrible race riots where you had attacks on the black communities. And these attacks on the black communities also triggered the migration north. So when you start to see what happened after World War One, where black soldiers were proud having served in Europe, coming back in their uniforms, lynched because they wore their uniforms, you had black men and women being lynched. In 1920, for example, when you have black women gain the right to vote, you start having attacks on black women because they had the right to vote. So there were triggers that also resulted in migration.
And listeners, we would like to invite your family stories of the Great Migration from the American South to contribute to the oral history of this segment. If you're among our oldest listeners and you were personally part of it, you're invited to call and tell your Great Migration story at 212-433-WNYC, 433-9692, where in the South you came from and where in the North you arrived. Why did you go? Why did you come? What were the best and worst parts of being in New York or wherever your new place in the North was? 212-433-9692, or probably for many more of you, if it was your parents or your grandparents, or even before, who made the journey, we invite you to tell us a family story. Who moved north and why in your family? What was the best and worst thing about their new northern home? And how are you a product of your family's migration history, this part of American history, this official theme of Black History Month this year? Tell us your family's Great Migration story, or a little bit of it. 212-433-WNYC, 212-433-9692. Professor Brown Marshall, how much was the Great Migration what made Harlem a capital of Black America?
Well, so much of it at the time, when you think about it, these writers were coming, like Langston Hughes coming from the Midwest, others coming from the South, people coming from the Caribbean, and we really don't talk that much, even though there were quotas capping the number of people who could immigrate into the United States from the Caribbean. Those artists from the Caribbean, those activists from the Caribbean were also going into New York City, making this blend that became the Harlem Renaissance. During that time period, Dr. Carter G. Woodson founded ASALA, the Association for the Study of African American Life and History. It was also during that time period in 1915 on going forward that Negro History Week began, that then morphed into the Black History Month, where they said, wait a minute, all of this history from the African diaspora needs to be recorded. And so the recording of the migration patterns, as you were asking people about their family histories, became so important. The study of African American life, the study of the African diaspora, also becomes important for, you know, the Schomburg and for others who are now looking at this as the area of study, not just of the migrations, but what led to the migrations and what the history was 1,000 years ago becomes very important during this time period as people bring their histories into the cities.
And Dominique, you study Harlem history too, right?
Absolutely, and it's actually one of my favorite parts of our exhibition is we really look at that early part of Harlem's history. So a little bit even before the Harlem Renaissance, how does Harlem become a neighborhood where people can find resources, and how can they encounter one another in ways that let them see where they've been and see their stories and their migration. And so we talk, for instance, about Victoria Earle Matthews, a lesser-known figure from history who founds an organization called the White Rose Mission, and that provides resources specifically for migrant women coming up from the South. Then, as now, migrants are at risk for human trafficking. And so she would send workers from the White Rose Mission down to the docks to come retrieve women coming from the South and say, nope, don't go with that guy over there. Come up to Harlem. We've got a bed for you. We've got a warm meal and some job training. And so just finding ways to welcome people into the fold was part of what those early days of Harlem were all about.
Let's take a phone call and hear somebody's story. Wendy in Springfield, New Jersey. You're on WNYC. Hi, Wendy. Thanks so much for calling in.
Hi. Can you hear me?
Sure can.
Okay. My mother, Josephine E. Jones, came from Greenville, South Carolina in 1946 to Harlem. She was born in 1920, a South Carolina sharecropper's daughter. And by 1967, she had become maybe the first Black woman in management at a Fortune 500 company. That's Standard Brands, which is now Kraft Foods. She's also a Harlem activist that, with Michael Henry Adams, did everything she could to try to save the architectural treasures of Harlem.
Michael Henry Adams, who's been a guest on this show on exactly that topic. What kind of story does she tell you about the move and what worked for her early on or what didn't or why she left? Anything that stands out?
Well, I've written a book called An Extraordinary Life, Josephine E. Jones, which is an oral history with historical context in which my mother was telling me that she had a lot of discrimination against her, including the fact that she was renting a room with my father for $25 a week at a time, which was $100 a month, at a time when the rent, the median rent was something like $48 a month for, a one-bedroom apartment mm-hmm. in New York, in Harlem at that time. This would have been in the 50s. So she was paying, you know, a large percentage of her income for rent, and she had to work three jobs. And eventually the marriage broke up, and she did get the apartment at the correct rent, which is a wonderful fight, which is illustrated in the book. She talks about it in the book. It's really quite amazing. And she worked three jobs and sent me to private schools because the neighborhood school, which she went to in 1946 to vote in Harlem, because she lived in Harlem before she got married. She lived with a cousin in Harlem, mm-hmm. and she went to vote. And the school was reeking of urine and was covered with graffiti. And she said, if I ever get married and have a child, they will not go to a New York City public school. So mm-hmm. I didn't. All right. She worked three jobs so I could go to Dalton, mm-hmm. Yale, and Columbia. Mm-hmm. All right. And then I wrote this book about her. I became a writer, a professor, and now I've written this book about her.
Wendy, thank you so much for telling your story and sharing word on your book. Kellen in Harlem, you're on WNYC. Did I say your name right? Is it Kellen?
You did, yes. And love your show.
Thank you.
My family, we're all born on my father's side Louisiana, and my father, being the second oldest and the oldest, they traveled upstate here to New York when they heard about the Robert Moses Power Project, the capturing of the Niagara Falls and turning it into hydroelectricity. The project began in 1957, finished off in 61. I was born in 62, right there.
Mm-hmm.
And it was so much work that all 11 of my dad's brothers all got jobs. My grandmother finally migrated upstate as well once the boys had bought a home in Buffalo, New York, and that home was my favorite memory, my favorite place to be.
So they came looking for work. Were you, and did you hear stories of push factors out of Louisiana as well as the pull factor of the job upstate?
Most definitely the push factor was the KKK. There were several stories and memories even of my father's grandmother. Her husband was lynched right in the front yard because he knew how to read and write, and it was discovered.
Thank you very much for your story and for sharing it. Professor Brown Marshall, I you can react in any way you want to the first two callers. I'm thinking about the first caller and some of the ways that she said her family was received in the North. It's not like there wasn't racism up here. And, you know, I mean, even today we talk about people here and in Europe responding to the influx of refugees and migrants from across their borders in not always friendly ways. I'm curious what history tells us about how Northerners responded to the influx of Southern, quote, refugees in those days.
Well, you know, there were tensions not just between the European immigrants and the arrival of these Southern laborers, because the Southern laborers and African-American laborers were being paid less money. And so, for example, the Irish laborers would have these tensions because they felt like they were losing their jobs to these people coming up who were willing to take, you know, any work they could. And that sparked a lot of the Northern race riots that you had in Philadelphia and in tensions that you had in New York, Chicago, and other places where tensions between these different ethnic groups. But there were also those people who were on the railroad, and they got those jobs as porters on the railroad, and they got to discover the Northwest. So you had the Northwest movement as well, and I know we have relatives in my family who said, they tell the story, they got on the railroad as porters, and they wanted to go as far from Texas as they possibly could, and they ended up in Yakima, Washington, Seattle, Washington. You had a lot of Louisiana people who went to California, and the whole idea was trying to find a life that was going to be without these tensions and that where they could find work. And so it was always less pay than the other groups received, but it was more than they would have received when they were down south.
You know, I think we have one of those railroad-related stories from a caller waiting to go. Susan in Teaneck, you're on WNYC. Susan, thanks so much for calling.
Well, thank you for doing this segment. I have a slightly different migration as a biracial person, white-black, white mother, black father, from a white family, black families, both from Minneapolis, Minnesota in the 30s, 40s when my parents got married, and migrated eventually out of necessity from Minneapolis, Minnesota, backward to Chicago. Let's go south because the workforce for black men was so limited. And my parents were both college educated, both graduated from the University of Minnesota. And we wound up going the only place we could go with a white mother and a black father, and that was to a black area. And it was quite a project getting accepted with a reverse migration where I had to then deal with, as a seven-year-old in Chicago, people who didn't like my mother because she was white, where I had come from a very nurturing Scandinavian family that was really my mother's family because she was white, in Minneapolis. So hard to understand, but from two different viewpoints. So yes, black men had a real demeaning position. And my family originally began, I am searching for people now, they began in Louisiana. And somebody was a slave in a rice plantation down there and made their way to the Pullman Company. And that was the person that was my grandfather. But his family had to escape the plant, wherever the rice plantation was in Louisiana. So these migrations still go on. And now I'm recently in Minneapolis. I'm shocked. I walked around for 2 years from 2014 to 2016 asking every person of color I saw, where are the Negroes? Where are the black people? What happened? This is a town of Ethiopians, and that is not to their discredit because they have permeated
in Minneapolis.
That area.
Yeah.
So migrations are in play. That's a very stark contrast for somebody who comes from Chicago and grew up mainly in Manhattan and Teaneck, New Jersey.
Can I ask your grandfather, was he a Pullman porter, worked
he
on
was,
a train?
Indeed.
Was he in the union led by A. Philip Randolph?
He was indeed. In fact, he predated him.
Uh-huh.
But he did get in the union, and his papers are all on file. We've done a oral history for the Pullman Museum, which was collecting them while my father was still alive. My father tried it for a very short stint. It didn't agree with him. He was an accomplished musician. He was the best friend of the rock star Prince's father.
Huh.
Those kids are, I think one girl is still alive, Sharon. She lives in New York City. She was, we're the older kids. We're the older kids.
Mm-hmm.
That Prince's father, Prince, came from the younger kids. So
in
we used to babysit them.
Yeah.
Yep.
Susan, thank you so much for contributing. That was great. And we're going to continue in a minute with more listeners of your stories, your family's stories of coming north or west during the Great Migration from the American South, roughly 1916 to 1970. That's our topic in this week's edition of our four-part Black History Month series, which we're doing along with the Association for the Study of African American Life and History, official theme of Black History Month this year, which is Black Migrations. And we'll continue with more of your calls and stories at 212-433-WNYC, 433-9692, and historical context from Gloria Brown Marshall from the John Jay College of Criminal Justice and Dominique Jean-Louis, curatorial project historian at the New York Historical Society. Stay with us. Brian Lehrer on WNYC, part two of our four-part Black History Month series. on the official theme of Black History Month this year, Black Migrations. Today we're talking about the Great Migration from the South, 1916 through 1970, with Gloria Brown Marshall from John Jay and Dominique Jean-Louis, curatorial project historian at the New York Historical Society, where, by the way, her exhibit, the exhibit that she worked on is still up into March, called Black Citizenship in the Age of Jim Crow. And does that kind of lead, Dominique, into, is that sort of the prehistory of what then became the Great Migration?
Absolutely. So our exhibition begins at the end of the Civil War and really takes us through both the history of Reconstruction, when rights are expanded for the African-American community in terms of voting rights for African-American men, in terms of the idea of birthright citizenship in the 14th Amendment, and then takes us through the rise of the Jim Crow era, so when those rights begin to be rolled back. And so much of that is the pretext to the Great Migration, the rise in violence, as your callers mentioned, their experiences with the Ku Klux Klan, that really, that violence is part of that story. At the end of Reconstruction, this violence comes back. And then economically as well, with the end of slavery comes the rise of sharecropping and this inability for Black workers to find work outside of poorly compensated agricultural work. It's actually the case that most people who came to the North during the Great Migration came from southern cities and not just from the farms, in part because that lifestyle just became so untenable in the period before the Great Migration that they were moving to cities like Charleston and like Atlanta, and then from there would hear these amazing stories of opportunity in the North and chose to continue that journey up north.
Let's hear a story from Niles in Atlanta. Hey, from New York, Niles. Thanks so much for calling us.
Hi, Brian. How are you? I love the show. Thank you so much for having me.
Thank you.
All right. So my grandparents, they actually moved from South America in the 70s. And I want to say that I think that's a very important story that has not been told. There are a lot of Black Latinos and Black Caribbean people who come up from the Caribbean and South America, and their story is not told as much. And I want to say that it's very important that we look at not only prejudice, but racism and prejudice in both communities. My aunts and uncles, who were children at the time, definitely experienced racism and prejudice, not only from the white communities, but from the Black communities as well, when they moved to cities like Brooklyn, things like that. They had to deal with slurs and also terms they are like fresh off the boat, things of that nature, coming over here. So being a Black immigrant is very interesting as well, coming up from South America. And I think it's also a part of the story that should be told, that there are Black people everywhere.
Yes.
So I think that's very important.
And what year was that in your family's case?
My grandparents, both sides, my father's side came from Trinidad in 1970. Both in 1970, exactly, mm-hmm. I believe. My mother's side came from Guyana, and my father's side came from Trinidad.
Niles, thank you so much. And I'll mention that next week, part three of this series would also include Niles' story, because we're going to talk specifically about Black migrations from Africa and the Caribbean as part of the big wave of immigrants that's really still coming to this country as a result of the 1965 Immigration Reform Act. So that's kind of, you know, it overlaps for those maybe last 5 years of what we consider the Great Migration from the American South. But Professor Brown Marshall, you were referencing before that Caribbean Americans were part of that Great Migration period too, right?
Yes, they were in the early 1900s, and you start to see them and Colin Cullen and many others who were coming through. But there were also organizations that were formed, and was mentioned by the sense of the Black women's clubs that were created. But we had the NAACP created out of New York City, and the Urban League. And the Urban League played a major role in this whole Great Migration, because they were the place that one would go coming from the South, from other places, to find work. And they would have listings of jobs in the Urban League. That's how the Urban League actually began, was because they wanted to be a place where they could have employment, where people can transition from the towns and cities they've come from in the South to the North. And so you had the Urban League, and also the Alpha Kappa Alpha sorority, for example, started in 1908, and other sororities, but Alpha Kappa Alpha, which I'm a member, and that's the first Black African American sorority. So you had all of these major women's organizations and social justice organizations and organizations also there that were courageously fighting on behalf of these newfound groups that were coming into the city. So there, it wasn't just this sense that people were victims, but they were also fighting back against oppression during this time as well.
Leonard and Teaneck, you're on WNYC. Hi, Leonard.
Oh, good morning. A pleasure to join your this momentous program. I'm glad I got on.
I'm honored that you're on. Tell us, you have a story about your father.
Well, a story about the father and the mother, and that includes the migration in the Midwest out of Georgia to Akron, Ohio. That's my father's family story. And my mother's family story is coming up into Virginia. And so both of them include the different aspects of the migration. And also, my father's story ties in with the World War One and the Birth of the Nation movie, which was the epitome of the blackface situation. In other words, the 1915, the Klansman book was transformed into this enormous film, The Birth of the Nation, which helped to spur racism against the African population. And so my grandfather was murdered in 1917 by the Klan, and by the 1918, they attempted to stay down south, but then the boll weevil wiped out the cotton crop for 3 years, 1916, 17, 18. So one of our family members went up to Akron, Ohio, and then he got involved in the automobile industry, the rubber industry, and he said, come on up out of the south, and you can make great money in the north. And so my father's family migrated in from Georgia into Akron, Ohio. And they were able to make a way for themselves. They were landowners down south. They were institution builders down south. They built their churches, their schools. So when they got up north, they got their jobs, they got their homes. They maintained and sustained their churches and their institutions. So it's a fantastic story. It's a tragic one in that we lost a grandfather, but the family was so resilient that they were able to restore themselves and make their way in the north.
Did you you said your grandfather was murdered by the Klan?
My grandfather, Jesse Jeffries, was murdered by the Klan in 1917, not because he was looking at a white woman or he was arrogant. He was a leader of the community. When I finally, I did work with Alex Haley for 5 years, and I was down south, and I went to his grave, and then I discovered, to my surprise, that the tallest tombstone in the graveyard was Jesse Jeffries. He had born in, he was born in 1914. My father was born in 1914. My father was the last of 13 children. He was born at the same year of W.E.B. Du Bois in 1968 in Georgia. And so he was born at the birth of the first Klan in the 1860s, and then he died at the hand of the rebirth of the Klan in 1917 with the Birth of the Nation movie, which was from the book The Klansman. And so, however, with that devastation, he had 13 children. Those children, my father was the last, and they were able to survive. They were able to thrive, and many of them are millionaires as we speak. We're talking about the Bronners, the hair people in Atlanta, and you're talking about other members of the family.
May I ask one more thing, and forgive me, I'm jumping in because of time, but it's so rare that we hear an individual story of somebody who is murdered by the Klan and somebody who either remembers it or, you know, remembers being told about it. What came down to you in terms of how the justice system responded to the murder, if at all?
Well, what came down to me was that black folks had to take their own circumstances and deal with it. they weren't looking for the larger society to deal with it. They were able to move out of the South and take the skills that they had in the South. They were landowners. They built their own homes. They built their own churches. The schoolhouse that they built in Georgia is still on a hill. It's over 100-something years, built by the family. So they took that ingenuity out of the South and planted in the North, and they weren't waiting for a helping hand. They had been builders. My grandfather's tombstones, the tallest tombstone in the graveyard there, he was born in 1868, died with the hand by the hands of the Klan, yes, in 1917. His tombstone is a Tekken. It's the symbol of rebirth and resurrection, the largest tombstone in the graveyard. And in the shadow of that tombstone is the school on a hill that they built. Generations went out of that school and went on to college and achieved it. They were not looking for justice. They were resilient. They could put their what they needed, the land, mm-hmm, the houses, mm-hmm, the industry in place.
Leonard, I'm going to have to leave it there, but thank you so much.
Dr. Leonard Jeffries, on both sides of his family, has an enormous story of migration. My mother's family migrated out of Virginia. They were inspired by Booker T. Washington, as well as W.E.B. Du Bois, and they came up from the South as Garveyites.
Thank you so much for your call. We're honored, so honored by your contribution. Thank you very much. We're just about out of time for today. Professor Brown Marshall, anything in response to that last story, if you like, so dramatic. But also, why did the era of the so-called Great Migration end in 1970? Was it things after the Civil Rights Movement made life more okay in the South, or why do we say that era ended in 1970?
I won't say it ended. I said it ebbed. There was still great movement around. I know my relatives moved out from Kansas, then to Colorado, and out to California. As I said, others lived in Washington. People went to live with relatives that were already established in Chicago and other places. So it ebbed, but it did not stop. But I think it was because of the 1964 Civil Rights Act, the 1965 Voting Rights Act, the Housing Act, federal legislation finally protected the rights of African Americans. Where we find, as the question was, what about justice? The justice system failed African Americans for centuries, and it continues to fail African Americans, but that's another story. But back then, there was no one who was arrested. The sheriff, the court system, prosecutors, these people did not go after these murderers. They took pictures of the hanging bodies. There were all the evidence necessary there to have a conviction, but no one did anything about it. So there was no justice. The justice that was pointed out by the listener was to pick up and leave and take your ingenuity elsewhere.
Dominique, a last thought on that same question?
Absolutely. I think that one of the things that gets kind of pulled out of this story is how much these encounters of people from different places changes the fabric of the city. I was just looking at an oral history by great migration painter Jacob Lawrence, who talks about just the smells of Harlem in the time period. A lot of migrants to Harlem came from Virginia and South Carolina, and so they brought their food traditions or musical traditions. He talks about street corner performers using washboards. When we think about the Great Migration, it's about these issues of politics and reasons why people leave, but also recognizing what a debt we owe those migrants for giving us the culture of these northern cities. We wouldn't have the Harlem Renaissance. We wouldn't have the culture we have coming out of Chicago. And so part of what our exhibit tries to do is to explain how the culture of New York's black communities really owes a debt to the Great Migration.
And that concludes part two of our four-part Black History Month series on Black migrations. We thank Dominique Jean-Louis from the New York Historical Society, whose exhibit is up through March. Also, on February 25th, she's going to be doing a talk, which kind of relates our previous segment on blackface to this one, Minstrelsy from Jim Crow to Digital Blackface. That'll be at the New York Historical Society on Monday, February 25th. And listeners, if by any chance you're going to be in Washington over President's Day weekend, on Saturday this weekend, February 16th, Professor Brown Marshall will be one of the panelists at the ASALH's 93rd Annual Black History Luncheon, moderated by the New Yorker's Jelani Cobb. Their theme is Black Migrations, which is why we're doing the Black Migrations series on Black History Month, or for Black History Month, on our show this year. And you can find out more about the theme of Black Migrations on their website, asalh.org. Thank you both so much for joining us.
Thanks so much for having me.
Brian Lehrer on WNYC as the crowd here at the Green Space laughs to Mo Rocca dancing to the Brian Lehrer Show theme.
Love the theme.
At least bopping in his chair. And by the way, listeners, for those of you listening to the show today and thinking, that sounds cool being in the Green Space to watch the show one day, we do it once a month in the Green Space, and you can already buy tickets for the next one, which will be 1 month from today. So that will be Wednesday, March 13th at WNYC.org/events/the green space, just so you know that they're available early.
Can I ask, by the way, is the Green Space part of the Green New Deal? Because if it is, I'm all in.
I'm going to have to talk to our sustainability officer and find out. So when Mo Rocca writes an obituary, what do you call it? A Mobituary, obviously. And you public radio listeners know Mo Rocca from Wait, Wait, Don't Tell Me. And he's also a CBS News Sunday morning correspondent and other things. And yes, his new podcast series is called Mobituary. So please welcome Mo Rocca to the Green
Thank you very much. I'm so happy to be here.
And what's the difference between an obituary and a mobituary?
Well, a mobituary is for someone who didn't get a proper send-off the first time around, or really any send-off at all in some cases. So it could be anyone from Audrey Hepburn, who in a way had the misfortune of not only dying way too early, but dying on the same day as Bill Clinton's inaugural, so she got pushed off the front page. Or someone like Elizabeth Jennings, who was kind of Rosa Parks 101 years before Rosa Parks right here in New York City. Sued a railroad company for being kicked off of a streetcar, and it led to the integration of New York City's transportation system.
But who remembers Elizabeth Jennings?
Exactly. So she deserves more than a mobituary. She deserves a statue and a lot else.
Audrey Hepburn, the actress whose obituary, surprisingly, you tell us, didn't even make the front page of the New York Times. So here is a clip from the podcast in which Mo, and he kind of gave away the spoiler here, speaks to Bill Clinton about this coincidence.
Were you aware that the day of your inauguration, Audrey Hepburn died?
No.
You didn't know that?
No.
You did not know
it
that?
It was a fairly busy time. I didn't sleep for 2 days.
Understandably, he'd been a little distracted. So to jog his memory, I brought along an old copy of the New York Times.
She was only 63. Yeah, I remember that. I remember how young I thought she was. I didn't think about it being my inaugural day.
Yeah, and then they put her back here. But it's a nice spread.
She was amazing. I loved her. I loved Roman Holiday. I loved Funny Face.
Sabrina,
I loved Breakfast at Tiffany's.
So great.
I loved Sabrina. I like the remake because I like the first one so much.
May be pushing it.
Did you know, besides the coincidence of the date, that he was such a fan?
I didn't know that. I didn't know that at all. But I actually remember I was living in New York already that day, and I remember passing by a kiosk, seeing newspapers there, and seeing that Audrey Hepburn was in the little reefer, what they call little reefer box at the bottom of the front page. And I remember that back in 1993 and thinking, wow, what an odd coincidence. And so it's the kind of thing that keeps me up at night.
And she wasn't even probably the most popular actor with the last name Hepburn.
No, she wasn't. And it was actually very funny in that episode of the podcast that Karen James, the writer for the New York Times, has only written two obituaries, Katharine Hepburn's and Audrey Hepburn's. So the Times has a chief Hepburn obituarist, apparently.
And we should say, you didn't choose Audrey Hepburn because she was literally pushed off the front page. You explore why she's still so popular today, and you make the case that people connect to Audrey Hepburn because of the trauma of her childhood, which came through in her acting. Would you talk about that?
Yeah, it's. I mean, it's. It is at heart a history podcast. I'm a big history buff, and I should say that I was working at Macy's as behind the fragrance counter in 1992 when I first came to New York. I was not a spritzer. Those are the people, the male models in front of the counter. I was behind the counter, sort of casting out my reel with the male model as the lure. I think that's right. I'm not really a fisherman, as you can tell. But anyway, I noticed that when she walked by my counter one day, I mean, it was a magical moment. Even if cell phones had existed back then, we would not have shoved our hands in front of her face for a selfie. Everything kind of stopped. And now she's been gone for more than a quarter of a century. And as you said, I wanted to sort of explore why she still has this hold, why she still trends on Twitter. And so we looked at her war years. We talked to both of her sons, and we hypothesize in this that what she went through in the war, she nearly starved to death when the Nazis had blockaded where she lived in Holland. She raised money for the resistance. And there's a certain kind of gratitude and empathy that comes through on screen. There were other actresses of that era that were as beautiful and as stylish, but we don't remember them. There's something that's punching through the screen, and I think that comes from that personal experience.
And some people might be surprised to find out that Audrey Hepburn felt a kinship with Anne Frank,
right?
And you found a clip of her talking about this on CBS in 1989.
I read the diary in Dutch, in Gallifrey, when it was still being edited. And it was one of the most devastating experiences I've ever had, because more than just reading a book, it was like having the whole war played back to me. She obviously was locked up inside. I was outside. And here was somebody who had been able to put on paper everything I'd felt during those years. And it destroyed me, I must say, and it has stayed an extremely emotional experience for me.
So that clip from the segment on Audrey Hepburn from Morocco's new series, Mobituaries. And one thing that's really interesting about these Mobits is that they're not just about real dead people. You even grapple with the deaths of fictional characters. One episode is dedicated entirely to sitcom characters.
Right. I've always been haunted by the sitcom Stasi, that sort of invisible secret police that comes and takes away sitcom characters without any explanation. And I think many of the people here in this audience are probably still reeling from the effects of the two Darrens on Bewitched. And to make it even more haunting, the sitcom Stasi thought they could pull one over on us by replacing Dick York with Dick Sargent and thinking, okay, you know, they're both named Dick. But one was clearly better than the other. And it was interesting. There's we talked to Lila Garrett, who is a writer, one of the few women who was writing in television back then. And she explained that because the second Darren had less chemistry with Samantha, Elizabeth Montgomery, who played a witch on Bewitched, that it threw off the balance of the show. And so you had to have the wonderful ancillary characters like Paul Lynde and Agnes Moorehead take on more of the comedy. We love those characters, but it was like my guest for that episode, Alan Sepinwall, TV critic, said it was kind of like the side dishes became the entree. And I talked to Henry Winkler about the Chuck Cunningham syndrome. Some people may remember, perhaps you've repressed it, that on Happy Days, Ron Howard's character, Richie Cunningham, had an older brother for the first two seasons. He basically walked through the scene, dribbling a basketball, eating a sandwich. And as the Fonz became more popular, it made sense. Gary Marshall, the very smart show creator, said, well, he's really the older brother. I mean, Richie Cunningham's going to go to the Fonz for advice on girls and things like that. So Chuck Cunningham had to be disappeared. There was just no two ways. And you can't kill the character since it's a sitcom.
Did they write him out, or did he just stop being there?
Psh, yeah, like, right.
And in that episode, you point out that characters don't usually die in sitcoms, unlike, say, characters in Law and Order or right. Game of Thrones.
Right, right. I think on Game of Thrones, it's about a 76% kill rate. Like, the characters die that much. And I died on Law and Order, Criminal Intent, and I blew up in a car in the first 5 minutes. but the residual's still the same, so that's okay. but we did talk to the fabulous Sandy Duncan, and she replaced Valerie Harper, some people may remember from In the Very, with all due respect, mediocre 1990 sitcom Valerie. Valerie Harper wanted more money, so they actually killed her character, so she died on the show. So so we explored different kinds of sitcom deaths.
And do you think we mourn symbolic losses like entertainment losses in some of the same ways that we would mourn a real life loved one? Not to trivialize real life mourning, but I think we see it in people's reactions to final episodes of shows they love going off the air, things like that.
Oh, sure. I was sorry to see Miss Ellie go on Dallas, but she had a good life. I think a lot of people do. I mean, the last episode of MASH, for heaven's sake. So, and I should say Henry Blake dying. And what made it even worse is that he went on to do the sitcom Hello, Larry. Bad move.
My guest is Mo Rocca. His new podcast series is called Mobituaries.
Can I tell you, a friend of mine heard Mobituaries and said, so is this just stuff that you complain about? this just an hour of you complaining? And I said, no.
I was looking to see if the TCH was in the spelling, but it wasn't. But the first episode of the series is on a comic named Vaughn Meader. Anybody here know that name? Raise your hands. Yes, probably those of a certain age who people might remember was a wildly popular impersonator of President Kennedy. So we're going to play a clip in a minute, but was Meader a controversial figure at the time?
Meader was surprisingly a controversial figure, and the first Family album, which was a sensation for a long time, the highest sounding comedy album of all time. And while
Kennedy was president.
Yes. I mean, while it sold more, I think, in a few weeks than My Fair Lady had sold in years, it was extraordinary. And when you go back and listen to it, you can hear it on YouTube, the whole thing. It's about a half hour long. It's like a gentle spoof of the Kennedy family. It's very affectionate. But what we found when we went and did this episode is it wasn't just about the death of a man's career, Vaughn Meader, whose career essentially died on November 22nd, 1963, but it was also about the death of a certain kind of political comedy, something, you know, I mean, it was what was really fascinating, Jack Parr introducing Vaughn Meader at the height of his success. You know, he's just going to come on, he's going to do a JFK impersonation. It's, again, it's very affectionate, but Jack Parr essentially apologizes ahead of time and says, I realize this is a little edgy. My goodness, how times have changed. And I'm not – and by the way, I'm not saying we should go back to that time. But one thing I'm hoping to do with this series is kind of memorialize a time, not just a person.
I think Colin Jost was just last weekend apologizing before Alec Baldwin came on to play Donald Trump. Kidding. But did Kennedy ever react to Vaughn Meader? Did they care?
Kennedy, in a press conference, and we included in the episode, did kind of – he was sort of good-humored about it. He said he thought that Vaughn Meader sounded more like Teddy. And so he seemed to handle it well. Jackie Kennedy did not like it, and she was kind of humorless about it. She thought that – she couldn't believe that this was happening. And again, if you hear the episode and want to hear the album again, I mean, it's gentle.
But the point – yeah. Here, I think, from a mobituary standpoint, yeah. Is when the real John F. Kennedy was assassinated, poof, there went Vaughn Meader's career.
I mean, it's – look, comedians are tortured as it is, and for this to happen, I mean, it's almost like Greek myth proportions of tragedy, and obviously he didn't biologically die, but almost symbolically it feels like Vaughn Meader lived for another 40 years and kind of wandering through the desert, and you know, part of what was so interesting about doing this episode was hearing from the man himself in the CBS News archives. There was an almost entirely unaired 90-minute interview.
Can I play? I have a minute
please,
of
please.
It. Should I play it, or do you want to set it up further?
I can set it up. I can set it up further. And it was. And so this interview, one of our great producers, Megan Marcus, found this interview in the CBS archives. 90 minutes of him shortly before his death. Really talking about what it was like to be treated as dead when you're still alive? Because people didn't want to look at him.
And so this is the last time that Vaughn Meader publicly did his JFK impersonation from this 1998 sit-down on CBS.
200 years ago in Concord, Massachusetts, a shot was fired that was heard around the world. 30-something years ago in Dallas, Texas, another shot was fired that was heard around the world. The first bullet fired from the Concord Bridge signaled the birth of the American spirit. The second bullet fired from the Texas Book Depository attempted to end that spirit. And we have seen in the last 30-something years how nearly successful that second bullet was. But in the final analysis, there is no bullet, there is no bomb, there is no power on the face of this earth that can destroy the American spirit. Maybe he'd say something like that. I don't know.
Whoa. You know, I didn't realize until just now, the second time I heard that clip, that he must have been asked, what might have John Kennedy said about his own assassination?
That's exactly what it was. A young producer way back in 1998 went down and found him in Florida, interviewed him, and then at the end asked him. And Vaughn Meader says he had not imitated Kennedy for a very long time, but asked what he might say now as Kennedy. That's what he came up with. He didn't come up with a cheap joke. And I mean, it's harrowing and poignant.
Let me touch on your episode called Forgotten Forerunners, and you gave us a preview of this before, talking about Elizabeth Jennings, a civil rights pioneer, 100 years before Rosa Parks. And there was, give us a sense of a case, the case around that with the future president, Chester Alan Arthur.
Sure. I'm a big presidential history buff, and I really like the obscure presidents, the ones all between Lincoln and Teddy Roosevelt with all the facial hair. Usually they live in Ohio. A couple of them were knocked off. They've got great mutton chops. And I was reading about Chester Alan Arthur, who I should say was not from Ohio. But anyway, I was reading a trivia book about these presidents, and it said that he had represented a woman, an African-American woman named Elizabeth Jennings in 1854 when she was kicked off a streetcar in Lower Manhattan. She was on her way to church, and she physically fought to get back on, and eventually they just threw her into the street, and the streets were disgusting then. If you've ever seen Gangs of New York, it's that area of the Five Points.
And we've got 30 seconds left in the show. Go ahead.
Oh, is there a clip?
I'm giving – No.
There's the time for questions? I love questions. Can't we just go another hour?
You're
Who's
gonna
next?
We're going to have to come back. We're going to – sorry, Allison, you don't get to do your show today. Mo Rocca wants to take questions. We will have to leave it there. With
I know, it's
Mo
really
Rocca.
Lousy.
You
know I love coming here. Mobituaries.
Yes. Well, I was going to take the time to say that. Correspondent for CBS Sunday Morning, panelist on Wait, Wait, Don't Tell Me. His new podcast series, Mobituaries, is about the history of people and things that have disappeared but continue to intrigue him. What's the next one up?
Sammy Davis Jr. And Sammy Davis Jr., we're dropping, as the kids say, this Friday. Greatest entertainer of the 20th century.
Wherever you get your podcasts. Audience, thank you so much for coming to the Green Space.
Thank
today.
You, Brian. I love talking to you.
Thank you so much, Brian Lehrer on WNYC. Thanks, everybody, for listening today. Thanks for listening to Brian Lehrer Weekend. We're back on the radio Monday morning at 10 a.m. In the meantime, follow us on Twitter at Brian Lehrer or Facebook.com/Brian Lehrer WNYC, where there's always a conversation 24/7.